This week on Writers, Inc.
I always want it to feel real, and I never care if the facts shake out straight. I never care if the timeline works, if the calendar works, if the family relations work. That never matters even a little bit to me. What matters is how it feels.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm a dewy-skinned Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. Before we get going, I want to plug a book. So my daughter got me a book for Christmas. I know nobody, you know, unless you're watching on YouTube, you can't see this. It's called The Journals of Spalding Gray. I don't know how she found it. I'm guessing that they had some kind of book fair at school and she got to pick the book that she wanted. She told me the cover looked scary and looked like something I would like to read. And I just finished it and it's honestly very good. Do you guys know who Spalding Gray is?
No,
the name rings a bell, but I'm not.
Yeah, so he was an actor that appeared in a lot of stuff, but never as a lead character. So he was always like one of the other supporting roles. And he had been around for a really long time. And I thought about this because Jenna, you had mentioned William Dafoe. This guy was actually William Dafoe's roommate for years and years when they were first starting off.
Whoa,
but,
really?
But what I liked about this, and my daughter obviously had no idea when she gave it to me, but it's a memoir, and they basically took this guy's like all his journal entries from his entire life and stuck them together in this book. And it starts off, basically with him wanting to become an aspiring actor, then him becoming an actor, then doing a lot of stuff in New York on Broadway and things like that. But where it gets interesting, at least for me, is at one point he gets in a really bad car accident. And like you can see the change in his mental state, because he's writing, as he's doing this. So you can see that shift over time. And ultimately, and spoiler alert, he commits suicide. So like literally his last written note is in this book. But like it chronicles this guy's entire life. But from an author's standpoint, I've always liked memoirs just because it, allows you to get into a real person's head. And hear their voice and their story. And for me, it's been, a huge tool for creating characters and for character development. So I'm bringing it up for two reasons. My daughter picked me an awesome book for Christmas. And as a learning tool, I think it's really great for authors. So if you don't want to pick up this one, pick up a memoir and check it out.
Yeah. Jenna got me to read a sociopath, a memoir by, what's her name? Patrice?
Grange.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my
gosh,
that was fascinating. So I recommend that memoir if you want to write sociopaths. It was a very good memoir.
Yeah.
On that note, I also recommend The Sociopath Next Door, which is a really interesting kind of deep dive
that's
into.
That's a good one too.
Yeah.
Is that the note your neighbor wrote about you?
No, that's no. That, that's yeah. 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 That's our local like HOA newsletter.
Nice. Perfect.
So
that is the perfect name for an HOA newsletter.
I think memoirs are great just because, especially like you said, writing characters, you just really get to learn, like, especially if they're, people that you're familiar with too, because you see events and then it's like, what are their interpretation or like, what were they going through during, so you have what you thought was happening versus what really happened. And I just think that's always such an interesting exercise.
And they're a great way to learn how to write an unreliable narrator. Because almost all of them are lying to you the entire time. I read a lot of memoirs and biographies and stuff, but I do think the memoirs are actually, in terms of learning craft as a writer, I think they are kind of invaluable because you get that sort of inner monologue thing that you're only going to get that from a memoir.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah. Another fun one is Green Lights from Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah.
He actually does the audiobook. So if you like audiobooks, that's a fun one to listen to.
Right, all right, all right.
Mm-hmm. This is not going to be remembered for anything else.
All right. He'll be president someday. That guy's got ambition.
Yeah. Maybe. I don't think president. Maybe governor.
Probably. They did ask him. Maybe governor.
Yeah,
What
I mean, and I think
country?
he actually even said, like,
Texas, right?
yeah, Texas. Which I don't know, man. I don't want him to, I don't want that. Not because I don't think he'd be a good governor, but because I don't want, I think that once you get into office, it's basically your character is ruined. So don't do it. You can do a lot more good, a lot, you can do better for the world if you just use your platform outside of government. I want to see the whole government thing come crashing to the ground. That's what I want to
Oh,
see.
Kevin.
The only one who really walked away from all that, so was Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Arnold, yeah.
Like he kind of just jumped, he stopped movies. He was governor for a little bit,
Kinda.
went back to
Yeah.
movies. I mean, he was older, so he wasn't able to do the same kind of movies, but
Yeah.
he didn't get hit with that what you're talking about, which, I would run as fast as I possibly could if somebody wanted me to run for office. Like I would hide and there's just no way. So, anyway, what is in the news?
All right. Well, first up, Spotify audiobooks solicits short audio content from independent authors. Spotify has launched a new website for authors to submit short English language content for possible audiobook creation and publication by Spotify. Authors are encouraged to submit adult romance, mystery slash thriller, or sci-fi slash fantasy stories of 10,000 to 20,000 words that are, quote, written specifically for audio. The program is open to authors who control their own audio rights. Spotify will pay in advance and royalties for any selected book and manage production. Authors can distribute the book in print or ebook on any platform. I was actually asked to contribute to this like long before they decided to announce it, and I have dropped the ball repeatedly. So, because it requires me to write something specifically for this
Yeah.
thing, and I just haven't gotten around to it.
Yeah. I don't have anything that length, and I was contemplating what specifically for audio means.
Well, Spotify, their membership works by hour, right? Like you pay them the fee and you can listen to a certain amount of time or something. It's
Yeah.
not
Well, I
token
think
based.
like their normal membership comes with a certain amount of hours, but I think that you can then do an add-on for more, but I'm not
Okay.
100% sure on
Because
what that structure looks like.
10,000 words translates to roughly an hour, like 40 minutes to an hour of
Yeah.
spoken audio.
Oh, nice.
So that's, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, a bunch of short stories, I would probably do that. I mean, I tend to grab a lot of those when I finish up a book on Audible, because Audible's got a lot of free stuff like that. So then I'll just kind of go through whatever the latest offerings are and the short stuff and listen to, two or three and then jump back into another book.
Yeah. I think I could do. I have a handful of short stories that are probably within this range that I could do. But if they, I gotta clarify and ask them. Does it? You're saying specifically for audio, like it, what does that mean? I want to clarify that, but
Yeah, I mean, obviously it said you can print it, so you keep print rights, but I mean, I guess they probably mean the style, but I'm not exactly clear on what the style is.
Well, I think like
Wait.
some like if you're creating something specifically for audio, it's, I just imagine that it has a different feel than, just a book or a story that happens to be read on audio. But I don't know how to articulate that.
I would check the terms just to be safe because I know on the Audible side, when they do like an audio exclusive deal with Audible, they have exclusive rights for 1 year. So you can't put out the print or ebook for 1 year and then you can circle back and you can do it.
Yeah.
But it also sounds like they are covering the cost of the narrator, which is a good thing. So like this is a good exposure for anybody, to get you in front of eyeballs or ears that wouldn't normally find you.
Worth a shot. Worth a try. Next up, NetGalley to launch consumer platform Booktrovert. NetGalley announced the launch of Booktrovert, a consumer marketing website scheduled to go live in the second quarter of this year. The platform will offer digital giveaways, special promotions, and book-related activities aimed at connecting readers with new books. Starting in early April, publishers, authors, and PR firms will be able to set up book giveaways on Booktrovert, which can be tailored to either public or specific audiences, gearing up for active user engagement upon launch. The word booktrovert is what's throwing me off right now
That's
because
a great word. I'm
it sounds
absolutely a
dirty to
booktrovert.
me. It's like,
Oh,
oh, you're a
no, it's like an
booktrovert.
introvert, Kevin. Get your
Which
mind
is,
out of the governor.
Yeah,
Did I?
that's bad
Yeah,
enough.
well, now, Kevin, we know some things about Kevin, don't
It's like yeah, that's
Don't
a
do that
just
to the books, Kevin. That's
I'm such
no,
a
that's
book
not
travert.
acceptable.
I need to be punished.
I kind of like Ned Gally in their current existence because they are great for promoting titles before they come out. And getting them in front of people to create that advanced buzz. They do have a problem though, which is, they've never, I don't think they've actively tried to solve it, but like their books are only supposed to be available to, influencers, to reviewers, to media, people that are in the world to create that advanced buzz. And right now they are not very good at screening out, anybody who is not on that list. If you sign up, you will get in, which means you can get advanced copies of, tons of books, in a lot of cases for free, which is why people do it. But from a publisher's standpoint, myself included, a lot of us are taking a step back and looking at that because, like, I see a lot of my fans now on NetGalley. People that I know, because I've seen them in other places, are literally just fans. They're not reviewers. They're not, part of that world. So, like, now they're expanding. So I don't know. I'm not sure if I like this.
Yeah, it seems like they're trying to be a little bit more like Goodreads, which traditionally does this kind of stuff. But I signed up just as a nobody and they started giving me books and I was always very concerned. Like if you don't leave a review, they won't give you more books. But that's absolutely not the case because I never leave a review for all the books we get in the podcast and they still give me whatever I ask for. My stats are like zero and they still give me books. So I don't know how this happens.
Well, I do know that like it does depend on the title and the publishers. Some publishers are like I request something from like Del Rey and like you have to like your stats matter. So it does depend. Some publishers are more lenient. And some titles like you can just do a read now and you can get it. So I think it depends on like I don't know. I can see it as like if they're reading, even if they're not leaving a review, if you read a book early and you're, even talking on social media vaguely or like in person, that it could help. But I don't know. It should be a little bit more for reviewers.
Not a bunch of book traverts.
Well, if the book traverts are talking to other book traverts, then I think that that is actually fine.
Sounds like the
That.
kind of thing you need to go to a meeting for, though. Hi, I'm Kevin. I'm a book travert. Hi,
Called book club,
Kevin.
Kevin.
Oh,
Called book club.
I think one of the problems that they're having, and this is industry wide, is the waters are just getting very muddy. If you go back 10 years, somebody either worked for a magazine or a newspaper or whatever, but like it was very easy to draw that line in the sand. And today, the kid that lives down the street might have 500,000 followers on Instagram, and do nothing but play video games on Twitch all day. But if you can get a book in that person's hand, he can get in front of a large audience. From NetGalley's standpoint, at least from my experience, like I typically book my titles through IBPA, which is the Independent Book Publishers Association, and they don't give you the option to review the reviewers before the titles go out. So if I put my book out through them, it's immediately available as one of those read now that Jenna just mentioned. If I go in as a publisher, which I can do, but it's I think almost two or three times as much money to do it that way, then I can review each request. But then they're putting the onus on me to sit there and go through the profiles and decide do I want to give this person a book or not give them a book. And I really feel they should just double down on being that gatekeeper, focus on one particular business model, because every time I see a company, try to spread their wings and scattershot like this, then they tend to dissolve because they're trying to do too many things and they're not doing any of them well.
I agree.
Do you think that some of this stemmed from the other one, was Edelweiss,
Edelweiss, yeah.
Edelweiss? And they were notoriously far more lenient than NetGalley. When I first started on NetGalley, it was re like you had to get approved, and it was very hard to get any titles. But then Edelweiss came along, and a lot of Instagram people went to Edelweiss and were talking about it all over social media. And I do think that after that, NetGalley got a lot more lenient. So,
Interesting. They should have
yeah.
stood their ground. They could own that space in a whole different way.
Well,
Oh
now
no,
someone
good
else has an opportunity, right? So there you
opportunity, you say. All
go.
right. Final story. ChatGPT firm reveals AI model that is, quote, good at creative writing. OpenAI has developed a new AI model that excels in creative writing, as announced by CEO Sam Altman. The model's impressive capabilities have sparked Altman's interest due to its high-quality written outputs, although it has not yet been released to the public. The revelation comes amid ongoing legal disputes between AI companies and the creative industries regarding the use of copyrighted materials for training AI models. The UK Publishers Association has criticized the models, seeing it as proof that AI technologies rely on copyrighted content, challenging Altman to address fairness in how AI models are trained. Meanwhile, Altman shared an example of the model's output on social media, which creatively discusses themes of AI and grief. Have any of you used Notebook LM?
No.
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 You have, JD, sort
Oh,
of
it
sideways,
through
because that's,
you. Yeah.
yeah. But the I'm gonna say something that's impressed me, and I was having a whole conversation with there's a YouTuber named David Cullen, and we were kind of trying to push it to its limits to see if we could make it break. Like, we were asking it, like, count from 1 to 20, and then alternate, which voice is doing it, and things like that. But we got some really interesting results from it. I'm gonna say that of all the AIs I've tinkered with, that one seems to have the best sort of creative output, because it's doing a quote deep dive and analyzing things and whatever. I think that if they're going in that direction, like something like what they're talking about here, with a more creative output, I think is inevitable. And I don't know how Google trained that Notebook LM thing, but I don't know. I'm sure they leveraged the billions and billions and billions of web pages they have access to, rather than stealing people's books. But who knows?
This just makes me sad. Like, I'm trying to think of something positive to say, but you know where this is all going. I mean, ultimately, like, I'm not worried about it, because even if the AI is capable of writing a killer novel, it's going to have its own AI type voice. Like,
Yeah.
I'm always going to have my voice. You guys are always going to have your voice, and voice is what the readers actually buy and what they come back for. So to me, it's just going to end up becoming one other competitor. What I'm curious about is, if you think about that AI voice, if you've got, let's say, a 10,000 people out there trying to generate novels using that same AI, is it going to use that same AI voice for those 10,000 novels, or are they going to be able to customize it further and create additional voices,
Yeah.
which will, I think, come later. It's going to be competition one way or the other. Just I don't think anybody knows quite what it's going to be.
So my take on this is, okay, have you ever used a Keurig coffee cup? One of the
I
little
have.
pods, okay? There are some Keurig pods that taste okay, right? If you just need a cup of Joe in the morning, you're in a hurry, you're going to put a bunch of cream and stuff in it anyway, you can get by. But most people who like coffee aren't going to drink Keurig, right? So
Right.
yeah, you can get your cup of coffee, or you can get your quick novel generated on the fly or whatever with machinery. But I prefer stopping at an actual independently owned coffee shop with a barista who knows what they're doing, and that, roasts and grinds their beans right in-house. That's going to be the experience I'm always going to want. And I think that's going to be the same thing that applies to our readers.
Fair.
I agree.
No,
All
no
right.
Keurig novels. Got it.
No
No
Keurig
Keurig.
novels. This is the Keurig of creative writing. That's what we're talking about here with
Yeah.
ChatGPT.
I'm going to keep my coffee snob comments to myself, because I don't want to put down the Keurig. So.
I had to imply that you could get perhaps a decent, or at least passable, cup of coffee with a Keurig, but I've never had one. But if
No.
you have out there in
Yeah.
podcast, feel free to
Yeah,
let
let
us.
us know. Let us know
Yeah.
what Keurig
Yeah.
is the best.
Hi, this is JD Barker. Authors often ask me, what is the best way to get my novel optioned for film or television? The truth is, there's no right or wrong way to make this happen. I've got 8 projects in the works with the folks in Hollywood, and no 2 of them came together in the same way. What I can tell you is you need to get your book in front of the decision makers. And one way to do that is with the help of our friends over at BookTrib.com. Through their Books to Screen program, they'll include your novel in a special insert in Screen Daily magazine. The magazine averages 38,000 readers in print and another 76,000 readers online, all of them film and TV insiders. They also distribute copies at the Cannes Film Festival. You can't get better coverage than that. If you want to see your book on the screen, visit booktrib.com. They'll help you get it there.
All right, JD, who is up this week?
This week, we've got Stephen Graham Jones coming on. Stephen's a New York Times bestselling author and recipient of several awards. He's also an English professor at the University of Colorado in Boulder. His latest novel is called The Buffalo Hunter Hunter and releases March 18th. Here he is, Stephen Graham Jones.
Well, thank you so much for being here today.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great. So, you know, our show, we have readers, but we also have a lot of writers. And so, you know, we like to start very at the beginning. What's your origin story, as it were? How did you get started writing?
Oh, man. Yeah, that's a big old long story. Well, I guess it's kind of a whole life, right? But where I grew up, all you could really do was farm cotton or go work in the oil fields. So being a writer or really doing anything with those two things was way out there. You know, I mean, I had one friend, he became a plumber eventually. Another friend became a police officer eventually, but most people farmed or worked in the oil fields. So I figured I had two choices basically. And I picked cotton fields because a lot of people I knew who went to the oil fields came back with their fingers all mangled or missing. And I didn't want that. So I figured I'd just drive tractor for the rest of my life. But then when I finally got my diploma, kind of round the back kind of way, not like the usual way, my mom took me out to dinner and she said, "You've always been reading books." Like, I was always the only one of any of my friends or anybody who read books. And she said, "You need to be among people who read books." And she had saved up enough money for me to go to one semester of college. And so I went to one semester and sat in a classroom for the first time in my whole life where 17 of us had been assigned to read a book, and 17 of us read it and talked about it. You know, usually I was the only one who read it, and I would have to like resist being the person who's going to get beat up after class for knowing the answers, you know?
Right.
And so I kept going. And then my second semester of college, I'm sitting in what the advisor had told me was a monster class, which I was so excited about. But it turns out what they called a monster class was a class of like 400 people. It was size, not content. And I was quite bummed about that. I mean, it was like Canterbury Tales and Paradise Lost, all that kind of stuff, you know, in a big auditorium. So one day I was sitting in the back of the auditorium, very back row, with my knees propped up on the chair in front of me. I was wearing a tank top and gym shorts. And all I had with me was a spiral and a pen. And a couple of police officers come in and they lower their glasses because the lights are down, or they lower their sunglasses because the lights are down, and they look around, and I go lower and lower in my seat because in my experience, every time the police come into the room, they're always there for me. And sure enough, they were there for me. They pull me out and I slump out after them. I think, well, here comes another adventure. But turns out that I was not in trouble for once. What happened was one of my uncles had been burned over 95% of his body, terrible, terrible, terrible burns, and they had airlifted him to the town I was in, to the burn unit ICU, and I was the only family member they could find. So they took me to the burn unit ICU, and I sat there for 3 days and three nights waiting for him to live or die, and I had that pen and that spiral with me. And after the first day, I had read all the magazines, and I was living out of the vending machine. And I got bored and I wrote a story, my first story ever, when I was 19. And when I came back to my composition 2 class on Monday, after having missed Wednesday and Friday, I had not written the personal essay I was supposed to write that weekend, but I tore that story out of my notebook, crimped it at the top, and left it on the teacher's desk with everyone else's essays. I figured she could at least see I was writing, even if it was off topic, and even if it wasn't typed. Everybody had their stuff typed or what word processed or whatever, and I didn't have any of that stuff. I just had a pen. And lo and behold, later that week, I learned that she not only read it, which she shouldn't have done, she liked it enough to give it to the creative writing faculty, one of whom typed it up and entered it into a departmental contest, which I ended up winning. And so I got $50, and that was amazing. $50 was it was an amazing amount of money for me when I was 19. And so I was off to the races. I was like, "You mean you can get money for telling lies?" I had no idea. You know, I've been doing it for free my whole life, but now I could get paid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're like, wait, what? That's perfect.
Hmm.
So, that obviously was just sort of written by the seat of your pants. How has your process, or has your process changed over the years? Do you find yourself outlining? Do you just sit down and go? How do you?
I just sit down and go. And usually at the last minute, like when I have a deadline of August, and that deadline started in March, I'll jack around until June, you know, and then I'll think, oh, I better get this done. And then I'll just do it really fast. That's the way it always goes. And I never have any idea where I'm going whatsoever. And it's just always a surprise to me. Like I kind of work on the idea that if there's no discovery for me, how can there be surprise for the reader? Which I'm not saying that's the way it is for everyone. A lot of writers are able to like generate or manipulate that surprise and discovery kind of process very intentionally, mechanically. And you can't tell, you can't see the gears and the levers, so it feels just the same. It's just we all have our different processes, I think. And I always have to fool myself into thinking that I'm just stumbling through. And I mean, I feel like I'm stumbling through, right? It's not fooling myself, but the places that I get sometimes feel like, how did this happen without any kind of foresight, any kind of intention, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. I mean, you have qu quite an array. I mean, you've published a lot of books, and they are very cohesive in the
Well,
end.
thank you. Thank you. Well, I mean, so some of that's due to the editors I've worked with. They make me make things make sense, you know? I'm never one, I don't like things to make sense, but I understand that they need to for people to digest them and engage them. But I always want it to feel real, and I never care if the facts shake out straight. I never care if the timeline works, if the calendar works, if the family relations work. That never matters even a little bit to me. What matters is how it feels.
Yeah, like the character journey.
Yeah, kind of. That's probably a big aspect of it for sure. But it's also just the flavor and the intensity and the dilation of the moment, you know?
Yeah. So you said you'll procrastinate until you have to, but you're also a full-time professor. It's not like you aren't juggling multiple things. So how do you manage to do everything that you do?
Not only being a professor, I mean, I say, you know, not being a professor, my class only meets on Tuesdays and Thursdays, but that's not the only work you do, of course. You know, there's a lot of
Right.
outside the classroom work and stuff to deal with. But and I'm also dealing with doing comic books, and I'm always talking to Hollywood people. It seems like once a week I'm having a big meeting with all these Hollywood people. And also I like to watch movies sometimes, you know, and read books I want to read,
Right.
and go ride I just like to ride my bike. That's my favorite thing. I just like to get out on the trail and just blast away for 4 hours and be out of touch. But how to balance it all? I feel like I'm always figuring that out, and I feel like I'm never figuring it out. I'm always just hanging on and catching up, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're doing a spectacular job, I think.
Oh, thank
I
you.
mean, I
Thank you.
can't speak for your classroom work. I would love to, but probably not going to, and that's fine. Do you have a writing schedule? Like, do you try to do if you have class on Tuesday and Thursday, then Monday, Wednesday, and Friday you write and you have to get a certain word count in?
No, I've never done that. I'm always jealous of writers who are able to do that. I always feel like someday I'll grow up and be that kind of writer, but I'm 53 already, so I don't know if it's going to happen. I'm more of a binge writer. I'm either a binge writer or like a sneak writer. Like I'll write for 10 minutes here throughout the day, 10 minutes here, 30 minutes there, 5 minutes here, and I just steal time from everything else and cobble that other together into like a writing session. If you know, when you add all these
Yeah.
minutes together, it becomes 2 or 3 hours. And then some days I don't write at all. Some weeks I don't write at all, but then other weeks I'll do nothing but write. That's just the only way I've ever known to do it. I think I'm kind of afraid of having a schedule actually, because I wonder if like I don't want writing to ever become a chore. I want writing to always feel like play. Like
Yeah.
I never understand people having to trick themselves to the keyboard. Like to me, like I'm trading food and daylight. I'm trading food and sleep and everything to get to the keyboard because that's what I want to do. I want to write all the time.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, just trying to go and keep that the joy of writing alive
Mm-hmm.
without, you know, kind of, yeah, that, I think that's a big struggle for a lot of writers, to be honest.
Well, I mean, part of keeping writing from being a chore to me is not buying into the idea that it's hard, that it's work, you know? I just have to always keep in mind that it's play. I'm getting to play with dragons. I'm getting to go to a made-up place and play with dragons, and how can that not be a gift, you know? And why would I not want to have that gift all the time?
Yeah. And so you mentioned, you know, you write comics, you've got dozens of short stories, novellas, novels. Do you have a favorite format that you write?
I like the impact a novel can have, like at the like the I don't know, the very end of the third J. Daniels book, say. Like I like bringing an audience to that, and I like getting there myself. But if I had to declare one single like medium or format for the rest of my career or my life, it might be flash fiction. I love operating within like 750 words. That to me is just so it's so difficult and so rewarding. And I love how the story is ending from the very first syllable of the very first word. And in order to tell a whole story, to get a whole world down on this single page of paper, the narrative has to do these unexpected backbends and contortions and shape itself in unconventional ways. Like maybe I have to tell the story as a recipe for biscuits. That's the only way to talk about this family, you know? And I just love that kind of stuff forever, ever.
Yeah, that. I hope you write a story about a family with a recipe of biscuits now. I think that that would be spectacular. Well, let's shift a little bit to your current book because we need to promote your current work. That's the nature of the business. The Buffalo Hunter Hunter. Why vampires? Where did this story come from?
I realized, I mean, I've done werewolves, and I love doing werewolves with mongrels, and of course I've done slashers and what haunted house and ghosts with mapping interior. I've done a lot of the little subgenres of horror. I haven't done possession yet. I'll get to that eventually, hopefully pretty soon here. But I realized that I had probably done, I don't know, between 8 and 15 vampire stories. I'm not even sure. I haven't counted them up, but I know I've done a few, and I always liked doing them. But I had never tried to tackle a long form narrative with vampires, and I think the reason I hadn't was because I had yet to figure out how a vampire would work for me. Which isn't to say I'm dissatisfied with everyone else's vampires. Everyone else's vampires are great, but for me to like believe in a creature or a person, then it has to have a biology and a kind of a culture that makes sense enough that I can invest in it emotionally and intellectually. And like it's like with mongrels, I was really insistent upon these werewolves. If like Darren weighs 172 pounds as a human, when he changes to a werewolf, he's going to also weigh 172 pounds. We need conservation of mass, you know? And for me to believe this is a cre for this to be a creature I can believe in, that conservation of mass has to be there. There is like a like that single rupture from reality that werewolves exist. But after that, it's like you do that Watchmen game. Like, what if superheroes were real? What would the ripples be? How would the world work?
Right,
And
yeah.
so that's what I wanted to do with vampires and the Buffalo Hunter Hunter. And, you know, big, and I say, I don't know if it's an impediment or obstacle is the right word. Maybe it's a license or an invitation. I'm not sure. But Christopher Beelman's The Lesser Dead is just the most amazing, it's just the most amazing novel in the first place, but it's also a vampire novel. And when I read that back when, what's that book? Like probably 10 years old by now. I thought, well, I guess that's, I don't have to write, ever have to write a vampire novel because Beelman already did it, you know? But then I finally figured out a way to do it. Why vampires? That doesn't really answer the why vampires thing. I think it's why vampires. I think I wanted someone who could come at the buffalo hunter hunters or the buffalo hunters. I wanted a buffalo hunter hunter, and a vampire to me made the most sense. Someone, because you're not going to come at these dudes in the daytime while they're out popping buffalo, but you can come at them when they're all in one place at night, and that really appealed to me.
Yeah, that's well, you know, that's such a fascinating answer because you're vampires, and I don't want to give too much away, but they are quite unique in the world of vampires. The
Thank you.
law of the vampirism, how they work, and you know, there were also consequences, which I feel like isn't really explored so much in a lot of vampire novels as far as what they choose to feed on. So,
Well,
I
no,
mean,
I really feel like they're like so many of these horror creatures that we read about and write. It's almost like you've gotten a superpower, you know? And I've always feel like yeah, so you can, if you're a werewolf, yeah, you can run fast, you can jump high, but what's the price for that, you know? It's got to be a trade-off. It can't just be pure good. There's got to be a lot of bad in there. There's like I think it's like for me all horror stories, even whenever the protagonist or the hero wins, they win at a great cost to themselves. They ch have to chip off a little bit of their soul to make it through to the end, you know? In the same way, I think the vampire, the werewolf, and any of them, I guess the zombies excluded, zombies are just shells, but it's not like a joy. You can embrace what you are, like Darren does in Mongrels, you know? That doesn't mean it's pleasant or anything.
Yeah, no, I like you said that too, because like zombies, like all these different stories, these creatures, they sort of like they're all examinations of our human psyche, right? Like the zombie is about what humans would do if we had to work together in a combined space. And you know, vampires are interesting. What part of the human psyche were you hoping to examine or that you wanted conveyed?
You know, I think what I was wanting to interrogate anyways was the same thing I've been interrogating for a few books now with slashers, is what counts as justice. And sometimes it's point of view, because what looks like revenge to one person is justice to another person. But like how many generations between something can a thing still be punished for, you know? And I mean, is it at a certain point, does it matter? And is it fair? Maybe that's what I'm really asking. Is it fair, you know?
Yeah, no, that message definitely comes through. And there's so much history in this novel. I mean, in some ways, the reality is more horrifying than the monsters. How did you find the space and the distance, you know, to write something that is steeped so deeply in realism and history versus your imagination?
I mean, number one, I guess I had to collapse the distance between me and that history in order to write from within it and feel the kind of like simmering rage that's the result of the things that happened. And that was zero problem at all, because I've felt that my whole life, because I've known about these events for my whole life. But as far as the realism goes, I think all horror needs to really engage. They like horror. Horror writers can really help themselves by reading a lot of the realism about like these literary stories, like I don't know, Ian McEwan, that kind of stuff. Because in order to scare the reader, you have to convince them that this world they're reading about is their world. And the way to make that parody is to make the world on the page real and similar to their own world. And so I think horror, more than any of the like fantastic genres, is bound to use a lot of the techniques of realism.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. That first story that you wrote, did that happen to be a horror?
It was, yeah. It
Was
was. It was a good story. Yeah.
it? Have
Yeah.
you always been drawn to horror as a genre?
I have, yeah. I've been, I mean, coming up, I guess I cut my teeth on Louis L'Amour and Conan the Barbarian. And then very quickly, I went to science thrillers. And science thrillers, long about when I was 16 or 17, turned into horror. And I've been with horror ever since. But I never left Westerns and science thrillers and all that stuff behind either. It's just, you don't have to, when you get one new genre, you don't have to throw out your other genres.
Yeah.
know.
Well, now I want. I mean, I suppose the Buffalo Hunter Hunter is a smidge of a Western
Yeah.
novel, a
Yeah.
Western horror novel. Yeah, it's so interesting that how those early experiences of what we read and are immersed with can
Yeah. Yeah.
shape our whole career.
No, it totally is. Yeah.
So you write horror, and there's a lot of things that can come out of horror, and your horror tends to have even a lot of gore, but also a lot of heart. Sometimes it stays inside the chest. What do you hope, if anything, that your readers take away from your books?
I hope that they laugh and cry in equal measures, and I hope that they are hesitant to turn the lights out when it's bedtime. If those three things can happen, then I'm completely thrilled,
Yeah. Do you tend to write about things that you personally are afraid of, or do you just sort of think about what is terrifying in the world and go from there?
The first way, I think, as a horror writer, you can like consult a survey group and say, well, people are afraid of spiders and drowning. I'm going to do a water spider story. But I think that's not the way to fear. That's not the way to get fear on the page. The way to get fear on the page is to lightly fictionalize your own nightmares. And so that's kind of what I do.
Lightly fictionalize your own nightmares. That has to go somewhere. That's probably your brand. We had recently talked to Adrian Chakowski, and
Yeah.
he it was really interesting, and I'd love to hear your thoughts
Yeah.
on it, because his goal was to take something that most people are afraid of, that he's fascinated with, and create empathy with it. And you lightly fictionalize your nightmares. Do you think that there's like, do you ever think about the empathy of the nightmares as you're writing them?
No, I never do. I think if I can make this nightmare particular enough on the page, then the reader is not going to get 100% of my terror. But if they even get 80% of it, that's plenty enough, And
Yeah.
yeah, and I bet like what's Adrian's Ogres? I read his Ogres. That was an amazing book. I
Yeah.
really that book really surprised me. I like that.
Yeah, he's an interesting writer, the perspective he takes. The structure of the Buffalo Hunter Hunter is sort of journals, but it's not a straight journal. It's a journal from the past, and then someone journaling about their conversations with someone else. So you've sort of have several layers of letters and memory going on in there. How did that structure come about? And was that easier to maintain that structure?
Yeah, it wasn't a hard structure to maintain. It comes really natural to me to nest narratives, probably just from all the Philip K. Dick I've read, because he's always doing nesting narratives and realities and everything. And so I'm really conditioned for and on that. But as for how it came about, I knew like the image I had, I think that started this whole novel for me was somebody needed a story from me a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, and I thought, oh, I'll just write a vampire story. And then I thought, what's a good vampire story? And I thought a good vampire story would be a priest has delivered a sermon and the congregation leaves and there's one person in the back sitting there. And that person is a vampire who wants to talk to a priest. And that's kind of where it started. And that's kind of where the structure comes from too. I initially thought it was just going to be one layer of nesting, that we were going to have some sort of readerly access to this old diary, journal, logbook, whatever it is. And in nested in that was gonna be the story that this vampire told the priest. But when I put pen to paper or keys to fingerboard or whatever to write this, I found that I couldn't come at it. I like me as a reader, if I encounter something like that, my first question is going to be, how am I reading this journal? I don't understand this. It doesn't make sense to me. Why do I have access? And so I needed a wrapper around all of that, kind of a bookend delivery
vehicle, I guess. And that, and Etsy just was there waiting, fully formed. I had no idea about her. And if I had, like, her name, Etsy, I don't know where in the world that comes from. But she just started talking, and she had it all going on. That's how I always know I'm in the right space for a novel, is when the characters just start doing it, and all I have to do is just keep up.
Oh, that's great. What has been the biggest surprise over the course of your career?
Yeah, that's a good question. The biggest surprise. Let me think. I guess that people read my acknowledgments, you know? Like, I know a lot of people skip acknowledgments, author's notes, but people seem to be reading them, so I'm happy. I'll keep doing them as long as they keep reading them. Probably longer than
They are
that,
very. They're very
really.
good. I think sometimes your acknowledgments have made me, particularly after the J. Daniel series, each one of those books, I think, it's like you can kind of keep it together and then you read your acknowledgments and you're just like, why did you do that to me, Stephen Graham Jones? It's not very
Good.
to
Thank
me.
you. Thank you. I'm glad Saga lets me do that. My first book with him, The Illingworth Indians, when they said they need my acknowledgments, I think I wrote back and I said, how long can I do these? And they said, just one paragraph. And I thought, oh, I just don't do any paragraph breaks. So I went like 6 pages with no paragraph break, and they let me keep it. And so that was just like the doors are flung open. I can do what I want now, you know?
Yeah, I mean, technically did what they asked. So we always like to end the show with a question for the listening writers out there, but what is one piece of advice you would give to the new or aspiring writer?
Just general writer or horror writer?
Any kind of writer.
I guess, I mean, it seems like an obvious one, but choose writing. Like, for years and years, I've been saying choose writing over everything but family, health. And I used to have a third thing, but it must not have been important because I cannot remember it anymore. So I think family and health, like without like a support system around you and without the physical ability to put pen to paper, keys to keyboard, whatever, you can't write. So you need family, you need health, but choose writing over everything else, over the bar, over the football game, over just everything. And that's the way to, like, tell story that it matters. And if story knows that you think it matters, it'll come visit you, I think.
Yeah, I love that. That's great. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a ball. Thank you.
Okay, so I've got to know. Do you guys read the acknowledgments of books?
Usually I do. Yeah. Most of the
Yeah,
time I do. Most of the time because I'm just like interested in who was their editor and who was their
yeah.
agent and who is supporting them. And
That's a good point.
I like the industry stuff, so I often do read the acknowledgments. And it gives you a little personality to see what's going on in their life. You have to tell me about his acknowledgments because
Oh, his
he had to tell me.
acknowledgments are fantastic. Like they're almost as good as the book. I
Oh,
mean,
wow.
yeah, I always read the acknowledgments, which is how I discovered his acknowledgments, but they are always just so they give you like he explains sort of like where the story came from and, how it came to be essentially and why he was inspired to write that particular story. And but then he also he'll just he touches on like the personal stuff, but I don't they're just like these mini short stories and they're so personal and they're so wonderful and
See,
then
I do all
he'll
that stuff at the end. That's my,
That's right.
it's an afterword, I guess, but everything I create has a note at the end, and that's where I put all that stuff.
Oh, I don't know. Christine's gonna have to read his books, even though she doesn't read a lot of literary stuff, because like there, I've read a lot of afterwards, and like, I don't. He has such a good way of really just touching on like a lot of emotional things. So like, it just feels like he's talking to you in his acknowledgments. I guess that's what it is. It just feels like he's, clapping a hand on your shoulder and being like, let me tell you a little bit about this book. And you're just like, okay. And then he makes you cry and you're like, why did you do that to me? Anyway.
Well, that's like the constant reader thing from Stephen King, right? I
Yeah.
mean, those were always some of my favorites because it felt like he was talking to you, the reader who just finished his book.
Yeah.
And those are the acknowledgments that I like to read too. Like I'm on the opposite spectrum here from Christine. Like if I get to that page and I see that they're immediately going into thanking the industry people, you know, like I will gloss over it to see if there's anybody there that I know, but like I don't get into that. I really want to check in with the author. You know, I want to know where their head was at when they wrote the book, you know, little, you know, some kind of inside info on, you know, how it got to be. And you know, to me, that's, you know, just that's an opportunity, I think, for the author to actually have that one-on-one conversation with the reader, and I think every
Yeah.
author should take it.
I've seen you write your acknowledgments that way, JD. I know
I
you
do,
do.
yeah. I
Yeah.
like to. I mean, and it's funny because like a lot of my reviews mention it too. Like they like the, you know, they'll say, you know, the book got 5 stars, but that author's note and an exclamation mark, and they go into that, you know. So you can
Yeah.
touch the reader, you know, in a lot of different ways. That's a great way to
If you
stay in front of
read
them.
just to take a sampling of my reviews, like on Amazon, like over half of them are basically responses to that note at the end, that the last bit of the book where I get personal with it, where I talk about. Sometimes they're mad at me for it. For the most part, people are like responding to it. They'll even like, if I ask questions in that note, they'll actually respond with their answers in the review. So, and I'm thrilled by that, you know? Like,
That's
answer them,
cool.
man. Leave all those reviews. Like, get people curious about it. I am on board.
That's a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the other things I really think is interesting is, you know, I mean, he's a professor and he's a full-time writer and, you know, his career is just taking off in all kinds of ways. And, you know, writing schedules are always so interesting and most writers have some sort of schedule, but he likes to keep it as play. He doesn't want it to feel like it's a chore. So he tries to maintain that. And I thought that's like such a good idea, but also so hard to do. Like, do you think you guys could do that? Like, I don't know if I could like necessarily write consistently if I just made it play, but I don't know if I couldn't. I don't know.
I know I couldn't be an English professor and be a writer. Like I couldn't do both. I think it's Paul Tremblay who's a math professor, and then he
Oh,
writes horror.
wow.
You know, so like that makes sense to me. But you know, like having to, you know, work with students and grade papers all day and you know, let's face it, read horrible fiction and then go home and have to write fiction. Like I don't know that I would like that. That's too close to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to talk to myself sometimes when I get too serious to have fun. So I do that a lot. But you know, I'm kind of in the same boat because I have to work around the day job. You have to have some fun with it, or it's just like exhaustion. I've worked 8 hours. I've made dinner. I've done my kids' homework. I'm using my free time to write. So if it's just more like drudgery, I don't know. I think I would probably have a burnout meltdown. So I do intentionally talk to myself about have fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I make sure I schedule the time, but
Yeah.
I do try to tell myself to have fun.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have the ability to have fun with anything anymore.
I
It's
believe
just
that about you, Kevin.
soul is bereft of joy. But no,
Oh
I
my
so writing is it's the it's this thing, it's this it's a biological function for me. Like, you know, it's almost involuntary. Like I can't not write. And like I've actually had nights that were difficult for me to rest because in my dreams I'm writing something. A lot of and I do. I'll wake up correcting what I wrote. Like, no, that's not, that doesn't work. And I'll rewrite it while I'm laying there awake, you know? So I have this thing I'll tell people is like, somebody asked me the other night, like, what do you do for when you're not writing? Like, what are your hobbies? I'm like, all my hobbies become careers. I can't do things that I don't turn into work, I guess. So,
Yeah, my
yeah.
hobbies are writing and reading
Yeah,
and
my hobbies, yeah. You know,
occasionally
I
I
think
guess that's a good way to
mentally
keep the
kicking myself
fun
to
is to see
exercise.
it
That's
as
it.
a hobby instead of a
Yeah.
job. Yeah.
All that said, I do
Side hustle.
enjoy the writing though. So like I have fun with it. I have fun when I really get on a roll with it. So there's the work part of the writing. I got to come back to it every day. But then you'll hit that scene, and it's a little bit like, I think if you were, you know, if you were on a surfboard or something, you're paddling on, the water's kind of flat and still, but then, you know, finally this wave comes, you know, like you got to get out to the waves. That's the work. But then once that wave hits, man, it's a ride, and you know, you're running like glass. And I think that's the way it is for me, at least as a writer. There's the paddling, there's the work, but then here comes that wave, and now I can enjoy it, you know, the
I
fruit of
think
my
that's
labor.
fair. Yeah, I think that's probably similar because it's compulsion. I have to write. I don't know what I would be doing if I didn't write. Like, I would just be watching Netflix, which is not good for anyone. I mean, there's some good stuff on Netflix, but yeah, like I have to write, but then it's just like my attitude check. I'm like, well, are you too serious? Or are you having a good time? When I'm too serious, my writing's not as good. When I'm just
Well,
like
yeah.
looking at
See, if
it,
I'm
it's
not
like,
writing,
ah.
then I will become one of those stories on Netflix under that true crime
Wow.
documentary
The
lift.
dewy-skinned sociopath next
Dewey
door.
skin sociopath, Kevin Tumlinson.
I can hear your wife locking doors right now.
I want to like just talk to you about he talked about like, you know, that he doesn't really care about the fact, right? But then he also talked about how when thinking about making a creature, in this case a vampire, thinking about, you know, the biology and the culture and what makes sense to exist in this world. And I kind of thought like those two things are like you would think they would be similar, at least go hand in hand, but then they don't. So I want to know, when do you think about the facts of your story, and when creating villains or creatures or anything of that sort, like how much thought do you give into, you know, the things like culture and consequences and how their existence affects the story?
Thinking about the biology, like he had touched on that a little bit, I think that's really important because, as silly as it sounds, if you've got a person who turns into a werewolf, you know, they are occupying the same amount of mass. So, like, I think you need to use all of that. Because I've seen, like, that always bugs me. Like, when I watch a movie, you know, and you've got some guy turns into a, you know, think of Twilight, like those guys turned into like 500-pound werewolves, you know, but they weighed 150 before they made that transition. Like, yeah, that stuff, you know, even if it didn't look fake, if they could make it look real, like that completely takes you out of the story. So I think you've got to do that. And there's consequences to all of that too. And like, he's very good at nailing the, you know, the tiny little parts of all these things. And I forget the big pieces, but he gets all the little small stuff around it, and that's what makes it seem real.
Someone told me one time that the difference between technology in science fiction and technology in a thriller novel is that even if you make it up in a thriller novel, you still need to be able to explain it logically. And I think that as a general rule applies to just about anything in the thriller world. So like, you know, even if it's completely fabricated, if I can at least give you something halfway plausible as a background for why this MacGuffin works the way it does. It becomes acceptable to the reader.
I think I think about it too much. Like not with world, well, 'cause not with world building so much. Somewhat. But the stuff that I know about, I tend to go into too much. And it's like, nobody cares. Because I was a physics minor. So when I do my sci-fi, I'm like, nobody cares how this works.
Nobody
Black
does,
box
but
it.
doesn't it drive? Because like I write
You
a
know?
lot of physics into my. Into my
Yeah.
stuff, and it drives me nuts if I don't get to explain
But it
how
takes you
this
out of the
works.
story. Because then people really,
I
the more
know.
they start thinking about it, the more it pulls them out. So it's been something I've worked on to get that down as slim as possible into
Yeah,
lay
shorthand.
terms and move on. The same with brain stuff. Like, I'll be like, let me tell you how all of this works. And I'm like, no, just one sentence and move it on. And I think that's a skill in itself, too.
Oh, yeah, sure it is. I mean, I think like you do with creatures, it does get like, you know, the werewolves or even with vampires, you know, because I have read a lot of vampire books where they, or watched vampire movies where they just rely on like sort of the common tropes and it feels very, you know what I mean? Like there's no thought given to it. Like things just happen because this is how vampires work. And so I do appreciate when there is thought into why things happen the way they happen.
I think just to touch on what Christine mentioned, like I think it's really important for the author to work all these things out. So you could come up with 5 pages explaining how one particular thing works. And once you have that understanding, then you should be able to summarize and get it down to a sentence or two that's based on your fictitious fact, you know, like your understanding of how it works. And then you can make it seem believable.
All right. Awesome. And with that, JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got New York Times bestselling science fiction author John Scalzi coming on. Scalzi's debut is Old Man's War. It won him the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer. But since then, he's gone on to write a string of bestsellers. His latest is called When the Moon Hits Your Eye and releases March 25th. John Scalzi.
Sounds fantastic. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.